Last Sunday, I left off in the series on money and wealth, talking about acquiring money and wealth, and just barely got into that, and I'd like to resume there. And I want to talk about, first of all, the greatest means that any of us have to build wealth, and that is our incomes. And this is probably a fairly obvious point, but it's obvious and profound at the same time, I think. I think a lot of people think, oh, I could never be wealthy because I don't have wealthy parents or a rich uncle, or I don't have, you know, my parents don't have a business to leave to me, or whatever. The circumstances in my life, I don't make, you know, $250,000 a year, I'll never be wealthy. But that's faulty thinking, because anybody with a decent income can build wealth, can build a lot of it, as a matter of fact. Really, our income is our greatest wealth-building tool. And I got this idea from Dave Ramsey. I'm going to read you a couple of quotes from him. The first one is from his book, The Total Money Makeover. That's the first book I think you should get and read. And then the second one is from his book, Dave Ramsey's Complete Guide to Money. And that's the second book you should get and read, I believe. I read both of them and learned a lot from them. But anyway, he says here, I believe with everything within me that your most powerful wealth-building tool is your income. Ideas, strategies, goals, vision, focus, and even creative thinking are vastly important. But until you get control and full use of your income to build wealth, you will not build and keep wealth. Some of you might inherit money or win a jackpot, but that is dumb luck, not a proven plan for financial fitness. To build wealth, you will have to regain control of your income. And then in his next book, he reiterates this idea and mentions a slightly different thing, which is why I'm going to give you this quote also. He says, you'll hear this from me a lot. Your income is your most powerful wealth-building tool. But you'll only build that wealth and security if you free your income from accidental, careless spending and an endless cycle of debt payments. So in order to get control of our income, of course, we have to manage our money well, we have to be disciplined, and so on. And I'm going to talk about all that later. I'm not going to get into that right now. What I want to talk about now is the means to bringing in income. How do you get income? How do you earn money, in other words? And there's basically three ways of doing so. There are other ways. I'll talk about that later in the next week or two. But there are three main ways for an honest, normal person to do so. And that is by being an employee, by being self-employed, or by being an employer. The last two are similar. You can be self-employed and not be an employer. Every employer is self-employed. Every self-employed person, though, is not an employer. And so we're going to look at these three things. And I'm going to start by talking about employees, because most people are employees. I think from what I read in the Millionaire Next Door, I think they said like 20% of the population are self-employed. And among those 20%, most of them are poor, because most self-employed people don't make very much. Some people do. And most millionaires are self-employed, but most self-employed people are not millionaires. A lot of self-employed people make hardly anything. Everybody has this dream of starting their own business. Go talk to somebody who started their own business sometime. I mean, I think it's a great thing. I think everybody should have their own business, at least for a while, to understand how hard it is. But go talk to somebody about, you know, all the fantastic money you'll make when you start your own business. You know, you can work for 16 hours a day, probably make $2 or $3, maybe even $5 an hour if you're lucky, on average, and then, you know, probably eventually go out of business like 90% of them do. It's not easy at all. So that's why most people aren't cut out for it. Most people don't do it. Most people are employees. And it's interesting to me, just as a side note, that for some reason in our culture, in our society, and maybe this is across the world, I don't know, but I know in America, employees are celebrated. And employers are looked down upon and disdained for the most part. We have a Labor Day, right? We have a whole holiday here to celebrate and honor employees. You never notice we don't have Entrepreneurs Day, we don't have Business Owners Day, we don't have Self-Employed Day, we don't have Employers Day, right? We don't have any of that. We have Labor Day to celebrate laborers, and there's nothing wrong with being a laborer. That's great. But let me tell you what, if there were no employers, there'd be no laborers. what makes this country great is the entrepreneurs that start the businesses and produce things and hire other people. Employers are all too often seen as parasites living off the labor of their employees. This is how the average lefty looks at employers, how he looks at businesses. They're just a bunch of parasites. They just sit back, smoke cigars, have their little monocle, and carry around their big briefcase full of cash and live off the backs of all their employees. Their employees do all the work. They make all the money for them, and these business owners do nothing and just basically are just bloodsuckers. That's how a lot of people look at employers, which is a completely backwards, insane, stupid way to look at employment and employers versus employees. I think employers and entrepreneurs should be celebrated. Without them, most people would be unemployed and impoverished. I mean, you know how hard it is to be employed for yourself, or at least I think you do. I mean, it's pretty obvious. Well, imagine if everybody had to be employed for himself, and everybody would essentially be trying to grow his own food and live off of the labor of his own hands, and everybody would be extremely poor, because what you can do with your own two bare hands is very, very little. Everybody would be at a subsistence level. We ought to be really thankful for entrepreneurs who start businesses, who build capital, who make it so that we have opportunities. Those of us who are not entrepreneurs and self-employed, we have opportunities to work and produce way more than we ever could with our own two bare hands, and therefore have a lot more wealth than we ever would have a chance to on our own. If you think about it, just think about our own little town here. What makes this town great? Is it the city council? I think we have a good city council now, but are they what makes the town great? Not really. Is it the police department that makes the town great? They're important. Glad we have them, but they're not what makes the town great. Is it the firefighters? Is it the first responders? Is it the military? Is it all these other things that people love to laud all this praise on? Are they what really makes our town great? Or is it the business owners that make our town great? Take away the Elms. Take away Willow Spring, take away Ventana, take away other trails, take away Ray's Diner, take away all the other restaurants, take away the businesses, take away the people that provide the services and make the goods, take away all these businesses that provide jobs. Take all those away, and you got a bunch of houses left here, and what is this town but a bunch of houses? You know, it's the businesses. The businesses make this town great, and the people too. I mean, everybody contributes, but businesses are one of the fundamental things that make this town great and make every town great, if the town is great. So business owners should be honored, I think. I think they should be honored above politicians, above police, above firemen, above military, above all these other professions, because business owners are really what make us have a great quality of life. Now, maybe you disagree with me, but that's my opinion anyway. And I think if more people shared that opinion, it would make its way up into government, and governments would be easier on business owners. Governments would reduce regulations and taxes and all the things that make it so hard to go into business and to stay in business if they had a proper view of business. Things would be a lot better. But okay, off that soapbox now. Let's look at employees. Employees are called laborers in the Bible. I'll give you a verse here in a minute, but let me define the term first of all. A laborer is one who performs physical labor as a service or for a livelihood, especially one who does work requiring chiefly bodily strength or aptitude and little skill or training, as distinguished, for example, from an artisan, often with defining word prefixed as agricultural, like an agricultural laborer, bricklayers, dock, farmer, masons, laborer, etc. So that's referring mainly to unskilled, but you can also have skilled laborers, of course, too. Second definition is one who does work of any kind, a worker. So when the Bible talks about a laborer, he's talking about an employee, a worker, in other words. And the Bible teaches that laborers earn wages. We all know this, but it's just interesting to see the Bible. You know, nothing's changed in the last 2,000 years. John 4 and verse 36. Now, Jesus is, the context here is a different type of laborer. He's actually talking about gospel laborers, but the principle here is the same. you know, whether you're referring to gospel laborers or laborers, anybody that does any work for anybody. John 4 and verse 36. And he that reapeth receiveth wages, and gathereth fruit unto life eternal, that both he that soweth and he that reapeth may rejoice together. I'm not going to get into the details of what this is all talking about here. All I really wanted from that is that he that reapeth receiveth wages. So if a landowner would hire a laborer to go reap his harvest, he would receive wages for that. And laborers are hired for an agreed upon wage. If you're not hired for an agreed upon wage, you're called a slave, right? That would be a man taking you and forcing you to work and paying you whatever he wanted. Well, that's not how it works. No laborers work for whatever the employer wants to pay him. Ultimately, a laborer only works for what he agrees to work for, right? Now, the employer doesn't have to meet the employee's demands, but ultimately, if the employee is working for the employer, he's doing so because he has done so for an agreed upon wage. Let's look at this in Matthew 20, 1 through 2. This is why it irritates me when I hear people or politicians or anybody complaining about these evil corporations, these evil businesses that aren't paying people enough. You know, the bums in Washington, D.C., or in Jefferson City, or whatever, who want to complain about employers not paying enough, how much are they paying people? How many businesses are these guys starting and paying people? Of course, none, right? They've never started a business. They've never run a business. They've never paid anybody a penny. They've sucked, you know, resources off the taxpayers their whole lives. And then they want to complain about the people that actually start the business that they're not paying enough. Think about it. The people that never paid a penny wants to condemn people that are paying other people to work for them. That's pretty irritating to me. Matthew 20, verses 1 through 2. For the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is an householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, he sent them into his vineyard. Now, don't think of a penny the way that we think of pennies today. Obviously, a penny back then was worth a lot more than a penny is today. Nobody in their right mind would agree to work for 8 or 10 hours for a penny today. I guess they're talking about, Trump says he's going to get rid of the penny now. Because the penny is a huge waste of money. Like, literally, it costs 3 cents to produce a penny. The federal government spends, like, I forget how many billions of dollars, loses billions of dollars making pennies. So that's what happens when you debase the currency. When you take the copper out of them, they're not worth anything anymore. When they had copper in them, they'd be worth a penny or more. But anyway, whatever a penny was, I can tell you about what a penny was. You know what a penny was worth? A day's wages in unskilled labor, you know, going out there and picking grapes in a vineyard. You know, whatever you'd pay a person for a day's work today of picking grapes in a vineyard, you know, maybe that would be $10 an hour or something like that. So back then, if it was an 8-hour day, actually it looks like it was a 12-hour day. So $120, penny was worth $120 back then, something like that, whatever. You know, so the point is, though, these men agreed with the business owner for a penny a day. Contractual agreement. Nobody's getting screwed here. Nobody's getting ripped off. Nobody has any right to complain about any wages, period. Because you know what they would be doing if the guy didn't hire him for a penny a day? Be sitting on their butts doing nothing. They'd have nothing, right? So apparently this was a good deal, or they wouldn't have done it. They would have probably taken another deal. We'll get back to this passage in a little bit here. Now, a laborer's pay is called his hire in the Bible. Let's look at Deuteronomy 24, 14 through 15. Now, I, of course, think employers should pay a fair wage. That's right. That's good. And if they don't, though, the great thing about a free market is if you have an employer that doesn't pay a fair wage, other employers are going to pay a fair wage, and those employees are going to leave that corporation, that company, and they're going to go to another one, and they're going to force the guy that doesn't pay well to pay more or go out of business. So the market will take care of all this stuff. We don't need regulations and minimum wage laws and all this nonsense that does nothing but unemploy people. That's what minimum wage laws do. You know what minimum wage laws do? They make the weakest, the least educated, the least able among us, and the youngest, they make them unemployable. That's what minimum wage laws do. Look at what happened in California. They raised minimum wage to $15 an hour, and guess what? All the fast food joints are either going out of business or they're automating because they can't afford to pay it, right? So instead of these kids mainly, kids are the only ones that make minimum wage typically. There's a few adults that do, but for the most part, it's just kids that make it. It's their first step on the rung of the ladder to get into, you know, better employment. And instead of giving them that first step and paying them what they're worth, which is, you know, a kid out of high school just starting out is worth not very much. Instead of paying him what he's worth and giving him a chance to, you know, start stepping up the ladder, no, we're just going to cut those bottom rungs of the ladder off so the poor kid can't even reach the bottom rung. And now he's going to be unemployed until who knows when. It's a stupid. Minimum wage laws are terrible. All they do is harm people. And furthermore, hardly anybody makes the minimum wage anyway. No, if you look at the number of non-kids that work for minimum wage, it's like almost zero. Like nobody makes it because employers are going to naturally have to pay more than that anyway. So it's totally useless. But let me get back to this. Deuteronomy 24, 14 through 15. Thou shalt not oppress a hired servant that is poor and needy, whether he be of thy brethren or of thy strangers that are in thy land within thy gates. At his day thou shalt give him his hire. See here, his hire is his pay, his wage. Neither shall the sun go down upon it, for he is poor and setteth his heart upon it, lest he cry against thee unto the Lord, and it be sin unto thee. Now we'll get back to this passage. I want to make another point from it later. But all I really wanted from it at this point is that his wage is called his hire. And you see, in those days, you got paid at the end of every day. Now we get paid, most people get paid every 2 weeks, some get paid every week, some get paid every month. But in those days, it was every day. And the employer was required to pay that. And he would be in trouble with God if he didn't. Now, let me give you another verse in Matthew 20 and verse 8, back in this passage, in this parable of the laborers in the vineyard. Matthew 20 and verse 8. So when even was come, the Lord of the vineyard saith unto his steward, call the laborers and give them their hire, beginning from the last unto the first. So their hire, their wages, in other words. Hire is payment contracted to be made for the temporary use of anything. It's payment contracted to be made for personal service or wages. And the Bible teaches that the laborer is worthy of his wages. So when a laborer works for agreed upon wages, he is worthy of them. It is owed to him. He deserves them. And the employer is legally obligated to pay him. Let's look at Luke 10 and verse 7. Luke 10 and verse 7. And in the same house again, let me read that again. And in the same house remain, eating and drinking such things as they give. He's talking to his apostles when he was going to send them out, that they were supposed to go to a house and preach the gospel there. If they were received, they were supposed to stay. If they weren't received, they were supposed to shake the dust off their feet and move on. Anyway, and then he goes on to say, so go to the house, eat and drink what they offer you, for the laborer is worthy of his hire. Go not from house to house. Again, the context here is gospel ministry, but the principle is true regardless. The laborer is worthy of his hire. So when somebody labors, he should be paid. Paul quotes this verse here, again, likening it, showing that the ministers ought to be paid for the work that they do. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 18. 1 Timothy 5, let's look at verses 17 and 18. Let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially they who labor in the word and doctrine. For the scripture saith, now he's going to quote from Luke, where the Lord Jesus Christ said, thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn, well, that's from the old, pardon me, that's from Deuteronomy, from the Old Testament. Then he quotes our Lord Jesus, and the laborer is worthy of his reward. So, laborers are worthy of their wage. Now, employees, you may think that I think that the employer is just, he's the one that has, he holds all the cards, he's the one in control of everything, and the employee has nothing to say about anything, and that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that at all. Employees have the right to negotiate their pay with their employer. They do have that right to negotiate. And of course, negotiation is a two-way street. The employer has a right to negotiate too. They both negotiate. And the employer can accept the employee's proposal or he can reject it, right? The employee can accept the employer's proposal or he can reject it. Both are free to take it if they want to ask for more, to offer less. They're both able to do that. I'm just going to give you a couple of examples here in the scripture of an employee negotiating his pay. Let's look at Genesis 29, 15 through 18. This is Jacob. Jacob negotiated his pay. Now, this was an interesting compensation package. Most people don't work for this kind of stuff, but you could if you wanted to. Genesis 29, 15 through 18. And Laban said unto Jacob, because thou art my brother, shouldest thou therefore serve me for naught, for nothing, in other words. Tell me, what shall thy wages be? And Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah was tender-eyed, but Rachel was beautiful and well-favored. And Jacob loved Rachel and said, I will serve thee 7 years for Rachel, thy younger daughter. And Laban said, it is better that I should give her to thee than that I should give her to another man. Abide with me. And Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed unto him but a few days for the love he had to her. Now Jacob was a wily man, but he wasn't a very good negotiator. You don't start off with 7 years, for goodness sake. Say, I'll serve you a year for her, or maybe, you know, maybe 7 months or something. And then he'd be like, oh, no, no, a year, that's she's worth way more than that. And then, you know, maybe work your way up to seven. You don't start at 7 years, you crazy? But anyway, and then because he was such a dolt, he ended up serving 14 years for her because Laban pulled the old switcheroo, gave him Leah instead of Rachel. Apparently there were no lights in the bedroom or something, I don't know. He didn't even realize it until after the fact. And then he wants his real wife, and he's like, well, you got to serve another 7 years for her. So, although Jacob and Laban were kind of, I think the two of them deserved each other, because Jacob was a shyster also. He stole his brother's birthright. And so anyway, sometimes what goes around comes around. But the point is there, he negotiated his wage. What shall thy wage be? I want Rachel, and I'll work for 7 years for her. So there's nothing wrong with an employee negotiating his pay. And then Jacob did this again with Laban in Genesis 30, 25 through 34. And it came to pass, when Rachel had borne Joseph, that Jacob said unto Laban, send me away that I may go unto mine own place and to my country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served thee, and let me go, for thou knowest my service which I have done thee. And Laban said unto him, I pray thee, if I have found favor in thine eyes, tarry, for I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake. And he said, appoint me thy wages, and I will give it. You see, the employer doesn't always have the upper hand. Here Laban's the employer. Jacob wants to quit, and Laban says, no, 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 I want to keep you. What do I have to pay to keep you? And this is the thing. If you're a good employee and you're diligent at your job and you go to quit, your employer is going to say, what do I have to pay to keep you? That's why if you don't think you're being paid enough and you want to switch jobs, go out and look for another job, but never accept another job and sign the contract before you talk to your employer. Because a lot of times your employer will say, oh, no, 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 what did he pay you? I'll match it. Now, you don't always want to do that, because if he wasn't paying you what you were worth in the first place, then you might not want to work for the guy, right? If he was not smart enough to pay you what you were worth. But it's also easier to stay in a job that you already know than it is to move to another one you don't know, and then you don't know how long that job might last. So I've known people that have done this, that were concerned they were going to lose their job, went out and interviewed, found another job, and accepted it, and then went back and turned in the 2 weeks' notice, and the employer says, what do you want? I'll give you anything. And by that point, I mean, you already signed a contract. You already gave them your word. You can't do anything about it. So, you know, don't ever accept a new job offer until you talk to your employer first. Then you can get the two of them competing against each other. Then you can go back to the other one and say, you know what? I really want to go with you, but my employer offered me X amount more. And then he'll say, well, okay, I'll give you more than that. So, you know, you might end up doing quite well. But anyway, the point is, from this story with Jacob and Laban here, that the employer doesn't always have the upper hand, especially if you're a good, diligent employee. But let's keep reading here. We left off in verse 28 when he said, and it says, and he said, appoint me thy wages, and I will give it. And he said unto him, thou knowest how I have served thee, and how thy cattle was with me, for it was little which thou hadst before I came, and it is now increased unto a multitude, and the Lord hath blessed thee since my coming. And now when I shall, when shall I provide for mine own house also? So, you know, the Lord's blessed you a lot through my labor. When am I going to start to realize some of this gain myself? And he said, what shall I give thee? And Jacob said, thou shalt not give me anything. If thou wilt do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep thy flock. I will pass through thy flock today, removing from thence all the speckled and spotted cattle, and all the brown cattle among the sheep, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and of such shall be my hire. So shall my righteousness answer for me in time to come, when it shall come for my hire before thy face. Every one that is not speckled and spotted among the goats, and brown among the sheep, that shall be counted stolen with me. And Laban said, behold, I would it might be according to thy word. And he removed that day all the goats, and so on. So the point is there that Jacob made this deal with Laban. I'll take the ones that are brown and speckled, you take the other ones, and that'll be my hire. And so then, once again, Jacob was pretty clever, and he figured out this thing to do, and he put certain, some kind of thing, rods, green poplar rods, in front of the cattle, and somehow it made the ones that were speckled and spotted produce more. And he ended up doing quite well, and Laban got the short end of the stick. But really the point from that was, it's fine for an employee to negotiate his wages. Nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with being a laborer in general. You know, that's what most people do, and it's a great deal. It's way easier to be an employee. I'll talk about that later today. I think I'll get to it anyway. Way easier to be an employee than it is an employer. There's no such thing as a base job, right? There's no such thing as some menial, low-life job that's beneath you, right? There's no such thing as a base job as long as it's honest work. A man does it diligently, he does it unto the Lord, and he does it with all his might. Regardless, if you're flipping burgers at McDonald's, there's nothing wrong with that job. And if you do that job with all your might, you won't be doing it for long. But let's look at Proverbs 14 first of all. Proverbs 14, 23. That's why, you know, getting back to the minimum wage thing, people say, well, it's impossible. You know, these people that work at fast food joints, they're not making a living wage. They can't possibly provide for their families. You know, this poor guy here has been working here at McDonald's for 15 years, and he's still only making $8 an hour. What are you still working at McDonald's for after 8 years? Have you not learned any skills that you can go apply to a better job or maybe get a management position or something? Why are you still flipping burgers after 8 years? I mean, there's something wrong here. And chances are, if you're still flipping burgers after 8 years, you probably don't have a family to provide for. You're probably single, right? So more than likely, you would have gone and found something else by this point if you had a family to provide for. So these arguments about the minimum wage are silly. But anyway, Proverbs 14 and verse 23. Proverbs 14:23. It says, in all labor there is profit, but the talk of the lips tendeth only to penury, poverty. In all labor there's profit. So that tells me that any job is profitable. Some are more profitable than others, but any job is profitable. There's no job that's beneath you. Now, if you can get a better job, it doesn't make sense to take a lower paying job, obviously, but there's nothing wrong, per se, with a lower paying job. As long as it's honest work and you do it diligently. Remember what Romans 12 and verse 11 says? That we're to be not slothful in business, fervent in spirit. Romans 12:11. Not slothful in business, not lazy in your work, in other words. Fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. You know, when you go to your job, you remember that you are serving the Lord at that job. Colossians 3:23-24. We easily forget. We easily think when you go to that job every week, every day, and you think, I'm just doing this job for the employer, or I'm doing it for my family, or I'm doing it for myself. But you got to stop thinking like that and think, I'm doing this for the Lord. I'm serving the Lord when I do this job. And if that's your attitude, you'd be surprised at what might happen and what opportunities might open up before you. Colossians 3:23-24. And whatsoever you do, do it heartily. With your heart, with your emotions, you put yourself into it. Do it heartily as to the Lord and not unto men, knowing that of the Lord ye shall receive the reward of the inheritance, for ye serve the Lord Christ. So if you do it to the Lord and not unto men, men will take notice. They'll see that there's something different about this guy. He works diligently. He works hard. He works as if he's working for some higher calling. And that'll show up in the quality of your work, and it'll make a difference. And then Solomon taught us that whatever we do, do it with all our might. My wife gets on me that I eat too fast. When we eat, my food's gone way before hers is. I don't eat very much, but whatever I do eat, I eat quickly. And she gets on me about that. And I constantly quote this verse to her. Whatsoever thou doest, do it with all thy might. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 10. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. If your hand finds a fork in it, it's time to eat. Do it with all your might. Actually, that's not a good idea. It's better to eat slowly, more healthy for you. You end up eating less that way too, as a matter of fact. But anyway, for there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. So it's like Jesus said, you've got to work while it's day, because night cometh and no man can work. So whatever you find to do, do it with all your might, because one of these days you're going to die and you're not going to be able to do any more work. Now, if a man works honestly, diligently, and as unto the Lord, he's not going to have that base job for very long. If he's diligent in his business, he's going places. Let's look at Proverbs 12:24. Now, this, of course, ties back into your income, because your income is your greatest wealth-building tool, right? Well, the more income you make, the more wealth you can build, right? All other things equal. Now, there's some people that will make less income and build a lot more wealth. Because it's not what you make, it's what you spend, right? So if you control your spending, you can still become wealthy if you don't make very much. But if you can figure out both ends of that equation, and you can make a lot and spend a little, then you'll build major wealth, and you'll build it quickly. And then, if you do that early, then once you've been around for a few years, you can slack up a little bit. You don't have to be so hyper frugal anymore, because you've done the work in the beginning, and now you've got interest and investments working for you instead of against you. And then, you know, you can enjoy your life after that. Some, you don't have to be quite so strict with yourself. If you do it the other way around, though, you have all your fun in the beginning of your life, you're going to work till the day you die. But we'll talk about that later. But he that's diligent in his business is going places. Proverbs 12 and verse 24. It says, the hand of the diligent shall bear rule, but the slothful shall be under tribute. Now, whether that's bearing rule in a civil sense or whether that's bearing rule in a company, right? Whether you're the owner of the company or you're a manager in the company, if you are diligent, you are going to bear rule. You're not going to be a peon for long. You're going up the ladder. You're moving places. Proverbs 22 and verse 29. Famous verse. Everybody knows this one or should. Proverbs 22, 29. Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men. Mean meaning base or average, right? Not meaning unkind, like we use it today. If you're diligent in your business, you'll stand before kings. Now, I've got some examples of people that did that very thing. Joseph, Daniel, you know, people like that. We'll look at that here in just a minute. Diligent, when speaking of persons, which is the primary definition, means constant in application, persevering in endeavor, assiduous, industrious, not idle, not negligent, not lazy. So a diligent person works hard and steadily. He doesn't goof around. He doesn't take a bunch of breaks all the time. He works with constant application and perseveres, not idle. It says there a diligent man is assiduous. Assiduous is constant in application to the business in hand, persevering, sedulous, unwearyingly diligent. And then it also said that diligent is industrious. Industrious is characterized by or showing intelligent or skillful work, skillful, able, clever, ingenious. It's characterized by or showing application, endeavor, or effort. Painstaking, zealous, attentive, careful. That's what's wrapped into that, the man that's diligent in his business. He works hard. He works constant when he is working. He also takes, you know, he takes rest too, but when he's working, he works constant. He works intelligently and skillfully, cleverly, ingeniously, attentively, zealously, carefully, painstakingly. That's the diligent man. And when you find a person that works like that, you're going to be calling him sir very soon, because he's going to be way up the list. He that works diligently will prosper. Proverbs 10 and verse 4. So if you want to increase your income, work diligently. You'll probably get a lot further in life working diligently than you will going and pursuing advanced degrees and education. You'll more than likely, in most circumstances, you'll get a lot further and have a lot less upfront cost doing it that way. Proverbs 10 and verse 4. He becometh poor that dealeth with a slack hand, but the hand of the diligent maketh rich. See how these are set in contrast with the word but there? The hand of the diligent is in contrast to the man that deals with a slack hand. I still remember, I don't know if you remember, Austin, when you did your exhortation up in Minneapolis on this topic. I forget exactly what you called it. And you read that verse and you said, you know, that people that are lazy are called slackers. And I never thought about that before. He dealeth with a slack hand, a slacker, in other words. He's going to be poor. But if you're diligent, you'll make rich. That's if you're diligent and you're wise. If you're diligent and you're a spendthrift, you're still going to be poor. So you get it both. You got to work hard and be wise with your money, which is going to be a big theme in this study. Proverbs 13 and verse 4 said, the soul of the sluggard desireth and hath nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made fat. See, the lazy guy, he just wants what the wealthy guy has. He doesn't want to work for it. He just wants it, right? He desires, but he has nothing. The diligent goes out there. Yeah, he wants it, and he goes out and works for it, and he gets it, right? That's the difference between lazy people and industrious people. And then Proverbs 21 and verse 5. Proverbs 21 and verse 5. The thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness, but of everyone that is hasty, only to want. And that's probably one of the big keys to people who are successful, self-employed people, entrepreneurs, business owners, is that their thoughts tend to plenteousness. They're thinking about how to be more efficient, how to produce things in a better way, how to meet their customers' needs and desires, right? Their thoughts are always thinking towards those ends. And when you think like that, when you have thoughts like that, it tends toward plenteousness. But people that are hasty and they don't think before they act and they just jump into something without having a business plan, without thinking it through, they end up coming to want. And that's why you see these businesses downtown. They're in and out. I mean, a lot of these places, in and out. They open up a little shop, it's there for a few months, and it's out of business. And I'm sure the people, I'm sure they really tried, they really worked hard, but they probably didn't think it through very well. They didn't have a business plan. They probably didn't do market research to figure out, is what I'm producing here, what I'm selling here, is this what people need and want or not? And so if you don't think like that and your thoughts don't tend to plenteousness, you're going to come to want. And that's sad. It's a terrible thing. It's a very painful thing for a business to fail. So let me give you some examples here of people in the Bible who were diligent in their business and they were promoted for it. Let's look at Joseph, Genesis 39, 1 through 6. Genesis 39, 1 through 6. And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down thither. Remember, Joseph's brethren sold him into slavery, sold him to the Ishmaelites, and they took him down into Egypt, and here he's sold as a slave. And things are looking very, very dim and dismal for Joseph. Like, he's a slave. How could this possibly turn out well? But it did. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And Joseph found grace in his sight and served him, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he had he put into his hand. So here, let me keep reading. And it came to pass from the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field, and he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught he had, save the bread which he did eat, and Joseph was a goodly person and well favored. So Joseph was such a diligent man and a godly man, and the Lord was with him, and he was a prosperous man, and prosperous means having continued success or good fortune, consistently successful, flourishing, thriving. So he was a diligent man, and this master that he's under that bought him as a slave, he sees how this man works and how diligent he is and productive he is. And so he puts him in charge of his house. And then his wealth just starts to increase. I mean, this man's house and his fields and everything are doing so well because of Joseph. And then he just puts everything under him. Joseph's managing his entire estate. This guy doesn't, the only thing he knows is the food that he's eating every day. That's the only thing. He's not even aware of anything else he has besides what he's eating, because Joseph's doing everything. See, this is the man that was diligent in his business, standing before kings, not before mean men. Well, then Potiphar's wife tries to get Joseph to lie with her. And Joseph rejects that. And she makes up this story. And he tried to rape her. And then he ends up being put in prison. The Potiphar took his wife's word over Joseph's. Apparently he didn't know his wife very well. So Joseph ends up in prison. And now he's as low as it gets again. I'm sure this was a miserable place to be, in an Egyptian prison. But guess what? Joseph was diligent in the prison and he got put in charge of the prison. And then eventually he gets released from the prison and he ends up becoming prime minister of Egypt. Genesis 41, 39 through 43. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, "For as much as God has showed thee all this," that was the dream that he interpreted, "there is none so discreet and wise as thou art. Thou shalt be over my house, and according unto thy word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne will I be greater than thou." And Joseph said unto Pharaoh said unto Joseph, "See, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. And he made him to ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried before him, "Bow the knee," and he made him ruler over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." So Joseph was made second in command of the most mighty, powerful empire in the world at that time. It'd be like being vice president of the United States, sort of, you know, that kind of thing. And it's because he was diligent at whatever he did, even when he was a prisoner. Joseph was successful in whatever he did because the Lord was with him, and he obviously worked diligently at it. So there's those two components. The Lord's got to be with you, first of all. Because if the Lord doesn't bless it, it's not going to happen. But then secondly, as the old saying that's not in the Bible goes that people think is in the Bible, God helps those who help themselves. Right? Joseph was diligent and the Lord blessed it. But Joseph wasn't the only one that stood before kings because of his good work ethic. David, likewise, was promoted in Saul's administration because he was diligent. 1 Samuel 18 and verse 5. And David went out whithersoever Saul sent him, and behaved himself wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So he went wherever Saul sent him. He did whatever his boss told him to do. He behaved himself wisely, right, which is extremely important. If you want to do well in work, behave yourself wisely. Don't be goofing around with the other idiots at work and doing what they do. Behave yourself wisely. And guess what happened to him? He was set over the men of war, basically made a captain in Saul's army. Then there was a man named Jeroboam, which didn't turn out so well, but in the beginning anyway, he was blessed because of his good work ethic. In 1 Kings 11 and verse 28, it says, "And the man Jeroboam was a mighty man of valor, and Solomon, seeing the young man that he was industrious," and you remember industrious means characterized by or showing intelligent or skillful work, skillful, able, clever, ingenious, characterized by or showing application, endeavor, or effort, painstaking, zealous, attentive, or careful. So here's a good, diligent, intelligent, skillful worker. "The young man that he was industrious, he made him ruler over all the charge of the house of Joseph." So he gave him a high position in the kingdom, because he was a diligent, hard worker. "He that is diligent in his business shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men." Then you remember Daniel, I'm sure. Daniel, because he was diligent, likewise was promoted to be pretty much second in command in I think it was the Persian Empire at that time. Daniel 6 and verse 3. Daniel 6 and verse 3. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. Daniel was wise. Daniel was diligent. Daniel was godly. And because of that, he was so good at his work, they couldn't find anything that he did wrong. These other presidents and these other people that were under Daniel, they didn't like Daniel. And so they couldn't find anything wrong, no fault in him in the kingdom. There in verse 4, you know, they sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. So they couldn't find where he'd ever cut any corners. He'd never done anything wrong, never done anything dishonest. He was faithful and diligent in his work, so they had to find fault with him for his religion. And they say, oh, here, Daniel's a man that prays. He prays three times a day. He opens up his window. This is public. He's not afraid to let his light shine. And so they go to the king and they say, hey, we got this idea. How about you sign this decree? Nobody can make any petition to any god or man except for you, king, for the next 30 days. Sounds good to a proud, foolish king, right? And he signs the decree, and it's the law of the Medes and the Persians. It altereth not, so you can't change it. And then Daniel finds out about the decree, and what's he do? He goes and hides himself in his house and closes up the windows so nobody can see, and he prays in secret. And then he deceives himself, saying, well, it's okay. I mean, I'm still praying. It's all right, you know. No, he goes up in his house. He opens his window. He does just like he did before, and he prays, and then they take him before the king. He gets thrown in the den of lions, and the Lord saves him out of the den. Close the lion's mouths. That's the kind of a man who's going places. And then you have the Apostle Paul in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul was diligent in his business, and he went places. In this case, he was going places in the ministry. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 10. 1 Corinthians 15:10. Paul writes here, he says, but by the grace of God, I am what I am. So he recognizes that he couldn't do any of it without God. Just like Joseph, right? It said of Joseph that the Lord was with him. Joseph couldn't have done any of that. Joseph would have never been promoted to chief of Potiphar's house or to prime minister of Egypt or anything without the Lord with him. So Paul recognizes that it's the grace of God. By the grace of God, I am what I am. And his grace, which was bestowed upon me, was not in vain. See, God, this wasn't done for nothing, right? God bestows this grace on him for a reason. But I labored more abundantly than they all. Yet not I, but the grace of God, which was with me. So yes, Paul had God's grace, but then Paul took God's grace and he labored more abundantly than the rest of the apostles. He worked harder than the rest, and it showed. Because Paul primarily turned the world upside down. Almost single-handedly. He had some help, obviously. But Paul worked so much harder than the rest that fully half of the books of the New Testament are written by him. All the rest of the writers of the New Testament combined did not write more books than Paul. The grace of God was not bestowed upon him in vain. He took what God gave him and then used it to the best of his ability. And he said that he was not behind the chiefest of the apostles. 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 5. Paul says, for I suppose I was not a whit behind the very chiefest apostles. Not behind them a bit. Even though he started out a lot later than they did, right? Those men had the blessing of having walked with Jesus for 3.5 years, the other apostles did. 3.5 years they spent walking with Jesus, learning of him personally, up close, hearing his teaching. They had 3.5 years at least, or maybe a little more. I'm not sure exactly when Paul was converted, but they had at least 3.5 years of extra experience, and yet Paul labored more diligently than they all and was not a whit behind even the chiefest of them. 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 11. He says, I am become a fool in glorying. Ye have compelled me, for I ought to have been commended of you. For in nothing am I behind the very chiefest apostles, though I be nothing. Not only was Paul at the top, Paul was also humble, though I be nothing. Paul recognized without the grace of God, he would have not been able to do anything that he did. So, if you're faithful in your current job, your boss will know that you'll be faithful with more responsibility, and you'll be promoted, if the Lord sees fit. Remember, promotion cometh neither from the east nor the west. East, west, I got that right. East or west, at least as I'm standing here, I'm not sure east, west, that would be, that's south, so anyway, east, west, whatever. You get the point, though, it doesn't matter. Promotion cometh neither from the east nor the west nor the south, but God is judge. He setteth up one and putteth down another. Psalm 75. So if the Lord sees fit, you will be promoted and blessed if you're faithful in your current job. Let me give you a verse. Luke 16 and verse 10. Luke 16 and verse 10. Jesus said, he that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. You find a person that's faithful in the little things, and he will be faithful in the big things. You find a person who is unfaithful in the little things, if he'll lie about some little thing, he'll lie about some big thing. Right? If you can trust him to do some little thing on the job when you're not watching him, you can trust him to do some big thing too. H. Jackson Brown, in his book, Life's Little Instruction Book, you'll hear me quote from this often, one of my favorite books, he said, when you find someone doing small things well, put him or her in charge of bigger things. And that's a good thing to remember if you are a supervisor or a company owner or a boss of some kind. You find somebody doing small things well, put him in charge of bigger things, because he's already proven himself. But if you're not faithful in your current position, why would anyone want to promote you to a higher one? Except in some perverse circumstances where, especially where unions are involved, where you do such a terrible job that they promote you to get rid of you. This happens all the time. He's such a lousy guy, but we can't fire him, so we'll promote him to get rid of him. And then he'll be somebody else's problem. Happens all the time. Stupid. That's the problem with unions. I'll talk about that probably next week. I probably won't get to them today because I'm running short on time. But verse 11, Luke 16, 11. If therefore ye have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? You know, if you can't be faithful in the little stuff, who's going to commit the real stuff to you? You think God's going to bless you with a promotion if you can't be faithful in the little that he's given you? You think he's going to give you more? You think your boss is going to do any differently? And if you're not faithful with your employer's equipment or his money or his customers, why would God give you your own business? Verse 12, Luke 16, 12. And if ye have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? You think God's going to bless you with your own business if you're not faithful with your employer's business? You need to have, when you're an employee, you need to have an ownership mindset. You need to, in your mind, pretend that whatever you're working with, you own. It's yours, because you always treat things that are your own better than somebody else's, in many cases anyway. It should really be the opposite. If I borrow something from somebody, I'm very, very careful to make sure I don't do anything to harm it. I'd probably be more careful with other people's stuff than my own in many cases. But you need to have that ownership mindset. I think it was Jim Rooma. He didn't tell me this, but he told somebody else this who told me. He said, when you work for somebody else and you have an office, you have a cubicle in some office somewhere, you consider that is your own, basically like this is this little office here, you're renting this from your employer. You are a self-employed entrepreneur. I don't know if that's what he said, but that's what I'm thinking. You're the business owner and you're renting this little space from your employer. And you're going to treat this like it's your own business. And whatever you have to do for this employer, you treat it like it's your own business. And I can definitely tell you that. Nobody treats your business like it was their own. No, that's why you can't. Typically, you think, oh, I'm going to buy a restaurant and pay somebody else to run it for me. Good luck. You're going out of business. Ain't going to happen, more than likely. Because nobody cares about your business like you care about it. Nobody will do for your business what you will do. It's just human nature. So you pretend like when you're working for somebody else that it's yours, that you own it, and you do it like you would if you were in business for yourself and your livelihood depended upon it. And when you do that, you're going places. And I think I will call it quits here for today. I have, oh, I don't know, a few more pages. Yes, more than a few. I'm not going to get to that. So we'll get to that stuff next Sunday, Lord willing. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention this morning.